And so that, you know, I think that absolutely, you know, sort of falls within the concept of genocide. If genocide involves, as again, it does in international law, for whatever that's worth, you know, forcibly transferring children of an oppressed group to a dominant group. So even without talking about, for example, you know, police violence or, you know, sort of white, you know, settler vigilante violence and sort of like the climate of popular violence against indigenous people that exists in large areas of this country, even just talking about, you know, structurally violent measures that have been put in place to disrupt the continuity and the, you know, the fabric of indigenous communities, I think it's just sort of, you know, nakedly obvious that what Canada has done is genocidal. I do sort of want to conclude on a positive note in terms of going back to, you know, the fact that there really has been a dramatic transformation in Canadian society in the past few decades that is represented by the fact that huge numbers of people have actually sort of rediscovered, you know, people whose families had, you know, under these incredibly coercive conditions, often sort of hidden their own identities, or again, people had been sort of cut off from the truth about their family history through these violent state policies, of people being able to, you know, to defy the impact of that and to reconnect, you know, with their history and with their indigenous nations. You know, indigenous populations are the fastest growing populations in Canada. And partly that has to do with, you know, birth rates and whatnot, but partly it has to do with the fact that more people in this society are realizing that they do have an indigenous connection in their history. So while, you know, we have to be, you know, aware that all these things have happened and these efforts to, you know, to destroy indigenous nations are ongoing, and that is an essential part of what Canada is about as a society, because I also should say that it's also very, very important to recognize that part of the point of all of these measures is rooted in the need or the desire of a settler society for more land. Part of the point of reducing the number of, you know, children who are born into indigenous communities, reducing the number of people who have those ties to those communities, is so that those communities occupy less physical space and that their land can be taken for, you know, settler uses and for capital accumulation. So all of these policies do reflect, you know, the heart of Canadian society, the heart of kind of the Canadian project as a settler colonial society. But, you know, it has been successfully resisted in a large way, and that, you know, indigenous nations and communities have survived and will continue to survive.
It's like, this is very true, you know, and that is something we need to recognize, and like their agency, like that resistance, that, well, really heroic resistance in the face of like this overwhelming force that is trying to crush them is like very, very, very significant. Of course, that would be a whole other talk if we wanted to get into like the different forms of resistance, and
of
maybe we'll have you back on at some point. We can discuss that. But yeah, like that is very important to recognize. I mean, that's not new either. You know, like even if you want to talk about like going back to Louis Riel, going back to the struggles in the 19th century, you know, this was never a, you know, accepted.
No.
You know, this was always resisted. You know, settler colonialism has always been resisted, still resisted now, and must continue to be resisted, like in the future. Like if we want to at all to see like a, you know, a just society.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that, like existing in this this part of the world, you know, like settler colonialism needs to be overcome for that to happen. I think that's very clear. So, thank you very much for coming on the show. I mean, this has been very important talk, like a very very important subject matter. Like once again, before Canada Day, a pushback against the official narrative, which I think is very crucial at this stage. So I really want to thank you for coming on. This is not an easy
Appreciate
thing to
the
talk about. Once again, this is not an easy thing to talk about. So I really want to applaud the fact that you were willing to do that.
I mean, I really do want to point out that, you know, what I'm drawing on here is, you know, the mostly, you know, histories that have been, you know, documented and recorded by, you know, by indigenous scholars
by indigenous
and by,
people.
You know, oral history work that's been done, you know, within within Indigenous communities, and again to, you know, to really encourage people to go to, you know, to go to those sources, and to really get, you know, the kind of the raw truth of this history, because it is, you know, a huge, I really do think it's a responsibility of every single person living in this country to look that history, you know, to look that history directly in the face, you know, and in a way that's, you know, based on listening to, you know, to the people who really experienced it.
Absolutely. So there we go. So that was Brendan Campisi here on Back in the USSR. And what I'm going to play now is I'm going to actually play a very appropriate song here. This is Willie Dunn, The Ballad of Crowfoot.
Comes the spring and its warm thaw. Around your neck, the eagle claw. Upon your head, the buffalo horn. Today, a great new chief is born. So raise him fast towards the sun. Heart now beats, a life's begun. It's 1821. Today a Blackfoot soul is born. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Your years are gone. The years have passed. Your heart is set. Your soul is cast. Stand before the council fire. You have the mind and the desire of notions wise. You speak so well, and in brave deeds you do excel. And it's 1853, and you stand the chief of Confederacy. You are the leader, you are the chief. You stand against both liar and thief. They trade, raise whiskey, steal your land, and they're coming in swift like the wind-blown sand. They shoot the buffalo, kill the game, and send their preachers into shame. And it's 1864, and you think of peace, and you think of war. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. See the settler in more numbers. He takes whatever he encounters. You see the Sioux, all battered, beaten, wrong and right. They haven't eaten, and as per se, we're much the same. It seems like such a heartless game, and it's 1876, and the enemy's full of those death-dealing tricks. Today the treaty stands on the table. Will you sign it? Are you able? It offers food and protection too. Do you really think they'll hold it true? It offers a reserve. Now, isn't that grand? And in return you see all of your land. And it's 1877, and you know the scales are so uneven. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Well, the buffalo are slaughtered, there's nothing to eat. The government's late again with the meat, and your people are riddled with the white man's disease. And in the summer they're sick, and in the winter they freeze. And sometimes you wonder why you signed that day, but they broke the treaties themselves anyway. And it's 1889, and your Death Star explodes, and then it falls. Why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Has swiftly grown, but yet for the Indian it's all the same. There's still hardship, there's still a pain, there's still hardship, there's still a strife. Its bitterness shines like a whetted knife. There's still hypocrisy, and the hate was that in the treaties. That the fate were all unhappy pawns in the government's game. And it's always the Indian who gets the blame. It's a problem which money can never lessen. And it's 1967. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? Been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow. Maybe one day you'll find honesty instead of the usual treachery. Perhaps one day the truth shall prevail, and the warmth of love which it doesn't take. Crowfoot, Crowfoot, why the tears? You've been a brave man for many years. Why the sadness? Why the sorrow? Maybe there'll be a better tomorrow.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
I'm Augusta.
I'm Charlotte.
We're Lonely Parade, and you're listening to CFRU.
If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach at cfru.ca for more information.
Put your finger on the groove with Planet Groove every Friday between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. for some soul-stirring funk, rock, blues, metal, and more with your funky, funky blues doctor on the dial at CFRU 93.3 FM.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Now, before the entire conversation I had with Brendan Campisi on the show about the struggles of Indigenous people, the genocide of Indigenous people in this country, I was talking, of course, about the immigration detention policies in the United States as well as Canada, which are currently in the media spotlight. And what I want to do right now is I actually want to play a very good and very timely interview that was done this past Thursday on the Real News Network, dealing with this particular issue, and really highlighting some of the problems of the coverage of it in mainstream media. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that right now.
It's the Real News Network. I'm Greg Gwilpert. The debates and controversies around President Trump's immigration policy has become one of the country's predominant issues. On the one side, we have the Republicans and Fox News supporting Trump's family separation policy, the indefinite detention of immigrant families, and now possibly the denial of due process rights for immigrants. On the other hand, we have the Democrats and liberal news outlets presenting the Trump administration's inhumanity with regard to these policies. A recent article in the Columbia Journalism Review, however, titled "Politics Pushes Central American Voices Out of Child Separation Coverage," argues that what most media outlets are missing is not only the voices of immigrants and longtime immigration experts, but also lack a historical perspective on the immigration debate. Joining me now is the article's author, Roberto Lovato. Roberto is a writer working out of the San Francisco Writers' Grotto, and has either worked on or reported on Central American refugee issues for almost 30 years. Thanks for joining us today, Roberto.
Glad to be with you, Greg.
So let's start with what the media coverage of the Trump administration's policies, immigration policies, has been like and how it has evolved. In your article, you suggest that there was a transition at some point from being relatively uncritical to being far more critical. What was this transition about?
Well, the transition from being not critical of the president to being critical takes place from not just the last 2 weeks, but from the last 10 years, from the Obama era to the Trump era, where I've spoken to people who were detained this last week, people that were not detained, they were in prison. They don't even use the word detained. And people like a woman I interviewed named Ana Luna, whose name I had to change because she wanted me to. Ana told me that she noticed how suddenly, quote, they're critical of the president, unquote, when they weren't, meaning they, the media. So there's a night and day treatment in terms of how President Obama was treated in separating and jailing children and their mothers, to Donald Trump's separating and jailing children and their mothers. I mean, the reporting would have us believe that Donald Trump's actions take place, kind of Deus Ex Machina, the God in the Machine comes out from on high and suddenly comes down on us, Hitler blitzkrieg-like. And oh my God, people start crying oceans of tears. When, in fact, among Central Americans, like Anna or like the advocates and scholars that are covering this issue for more than a decade, 20 years, even 30 years among some of us, there's been a lot of tears and oceans of tears as well. But somehow, the part that cried because of what the Democrats and Obama did to these imprisoned migrants and children, people put in tents, kids separated from their mothers. About 5,000 children were separated from their mothers and put in foster care, and mothers and fathers, and put in foster care by the Obama administration in 2011 alone. This, according to an important study by Seth Fried Wexler when he was at Race Forward. So we see a disparity in the coverage when there's a similarity in the treatment, a similarity that's not even made, right? They put like a wall between what Trump is doing as something utterly new and what Obama did, which is somehow a gentler, kindler form of, say, shrinking children's brains when they're in these immigrant prisons, as their psychologist told me happens after 6 weeks, or as if the trauma of a mother like Anna, separated by the Obama administration, or imprisoned by the Obama administration, exposed to conditions that drove some children and migrants to attempt suicide, to slit their wrists, to try to hang themselves, as if all that is kind of gentler and kindler than what Donald Trump is doing. It's astonishing, really, the layers of dehumanization, the different kinds of dehumanization.
So considering that now that there's a lot more outrage and intensity in coverage, wouldn't you say this is a good thing? I mean, for example, Time Magazine, of course, what's missing is this earlier coverage, but I'm saying, isn't it something positive to consider that now there's much more, that there is at least a focus on it? For example, when Time Magazine juxtaposed a crying Honduran immigrant child, a toddler basically, with a towering figure of Donald Trump, who was saying, "Welcome to America." What's your response to the use of this kind of imagery and this kind of coverage?
Well, I think there is some good to be had in the fact that a story that's more than 10 years old of child separation, Central American child separation, and the jailing of Central American children and mothers is now coming out. You know, what Central American scholars and Central American activists and Central American community have known in the Obama era, now everybody's getting to know in the Trump era. The problem is, again, that it's being narrated as if this didn't happen in the Obama era. And that's, I think, very dangerous in terms of, say, the way that Time Magazine cover story that you mentioned, where they have a Obama Trump standing over a child. They literally cut and paste the image of a crying girl who was not separated from her mother and put it on the cover next to Trump. So that's almost metaphoric of the way that I think liberal media and I think liberal progressive organizations are cutting and pasting and objectifying Central American identity, Central American pain, in what one scholar called violence porn, to use for political ends. So there's an objectification of migrants by the reactionaries, and there's an objectification of the Central American children and mothers by liberals and progressives, where basically the image of Central Americans that prevails, because you don't have any Central American voices except the crying voice, the crying voice of a mother, the crying voice of a child. So Central Americans in the narrative have been reduced to images and sounds and sound bites of pain. They don't, we don't, because my family's from El Salvador, truth, disclosure, full disclosure. We don't appear as fighters. I mean, in El Salvador, something on the order of 1/3 of all Salvadorans were organized against the state during the war, according to the Central American University. I mean, you have people that have a ferocious will to fight as any labor union in the United States will tell you. You wouldn't know it from the way the media coverage of Central American child separation is being told. It's being told primarily through the lens of a liberal, progressive media that it seems to be, not seems to be, is protecting Barack Obama at all costs from the heat of this major intense issue that stirs a lot of emotions. So it's no coincidence that instead of central, it seems that the expertise among Democratic Party operatives and Obama, ex-Obama officials is greater than that of Central Americans, because they appear exponentially more than Central Americans do. In fact, Central Americans don't appear in a single, not one, ni uno, ni un articulo about the Central American separation, child separation story of the last few weeks. This raises the question, what are people actually crying about, right? Because that image is not backed up. That those sounds aren't backed up by context, by storytelling from people who are more complex than just crying and suffering. That story is not backed up by scholars who spent their lifetimes analyzing and studying this. That story is being backed up by Democratic Party operatives, liberal media, who basically cut and paste images and sounds of Central American suffering and pain and put it up for mass consumption in order to beat up Donald Trump and cover for Barack Obama.
Well, actually, speaking of the covering for Barack Obama and the lack of historical context, I mean, what would you say are the consequences of leaving that type of historical context out of the picture? I mean, is it that Obama's policies directly contributed to an intensification, perhaps, of the Trump administration's policies, or would you say that they're basically the same?
Well, as far as separating children, Barack Obama separated children from their mothers. As far as putting children in tents, Barack Obama put children in tents. He separated thousands of children from their mothers. 2011 alone, more than 5,100 children were separated from their mothers and fathers and put in foster care. Again, that's according to Race Forward. You can look at a story by McClatchy that basically confirms this as well. So when you don't report that and you put it all on Donald Trump, you basically don't really want to look at the policy foundation for this truly terrifying action by Donald Trump and those of Barack Obama. Because when I interview Anna Luna, she's describing to me twitching in the face, women who try to slit their wrists, boys who try to hang themselves, twitching arms involuntarily, all signs of trauma and extreme layers of trauma, according to psychologists I've interviewed. So when you don't have a historical accounting of that, you're basically allowing that to be normalized in the, say, the national unconscious of the United States, in the political unconscious of the United States. And so we are all being brought into, by Donald Trump, but also by the Democrats, into normalizing this kind of policy and treatment, because it goes kind of really notice when an evil bad guy who's, I would say it's like the Jungian shadow of the United States, but then covered up by what I would call the denial mechanism that is the Obama administration and the Democratic Party with respect to Central American children and mothers.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for now. I was speaking to Roberto Lovato, a longtime writer on Central American refugee issues and author of the recently published Columbia Journalism Review article, Politics Pushes Central American Voices Out of Child Separation Coverage. Thanks for joining us today, Roberto.
Glad to be with you, Greg.
And thank you for joining the Real News Network. Also, if you like stories such as this.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me di
trenes clandestinos por no llevar papel. Pa una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebra ley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
Je flaire les kilomètres de ma société, les kilomètres de son sang. Je flaire ce mot du monde, je m'avais à caravane de la Chine, je suis mort italien. Oui, j'ai l'air en bas chez le gazier. Regardez à quel point il est là.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Manu Chao with Clandestino. And and that was, of course, the coverage on the Real News about the, you know, you could say, like, needless to say, the, like, putting it very bluntly and almost understating it, the problems that the mainstream media in the U.S. has when it comes to talking about this issue of, like, the separation of migrant children from their parents. Now, what I want to do right now, just to round the show out, is I want to play, for those of you who didn't listen to it last week, I'm going to play the interview I did with Clara Sorrenti of the Communist Party of Canada, who ran in the provincial election in London, one of the ridings in London. And the interview that we actually talked about, we actually did actually even touch on some of these issues we talked about today. And it's very wide-ranging, and so I think it's definitely, even if you have heard it before, it's worth a second listen. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. We'll see you all here next week. Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and at long last, after quite a few delays, quite a few little mishaps, and the fact that the rules concerning election coverage, as I've talked about before on the show, kind of prohibited me from doing this interview before. But anyways, I hope I have Clara Sorrenti on the line from Ottawa. Now, Clara, can you hear me?
From London.
From London. That's London, Ontario, by the way. Let's make that very, very clear.
Thank you for clarifying that one.
Yes. So anyway, Clara is the was the Communist Party candidate in the provincial election in London. North Centre, I believe, is the riding you were in, right? Because, I mean,
The provincial leader of the Communist Party of Canada, Ontario, ran in London North Centre in the previous election, too. And
right. That's true. I think I remember that. So basically, Clara has been described in, I've been planning on interviewing her for a while now. I mean, she was running quite an energetic campaign in the provincial election there, which was a very hard fought campaign definitely in London. I mean, that wasn't the only place, but definitely there. And she was described as young, determined, unapologetically communist by the London Fuse on June 4th, 2018 in an article down there, and she was running, like I say, running in the Communist Party candidate in London North Centre riding, which was the riding held by the former health minister, if I recall. Was that right?
I am not actually aware of that.
Yeah, it said that the Liberal MPP and health minister Deb Matthews, who was not seeking re-election.
Oh, Oh, yes. Kate Graham ran.
Okay. That's kind of what I was wondering about. So, anyways, I want to ask you just right off the bat, the first question is more or less, why did you decide to run in this election? And what do you believe was really at stake in this election? What really made it so important?
Well, the reason I decided to run in the election is because since I turned 18, I had always been involved in electoral politics. I first got involved with the New Democratic Party on Peggy Sattler's campaign. I was nominator when she ran against current city councilor Mohammed Salih. But around that time, socialism was removed from the constitution of the NDP.
Mm-hmm.
They pushed the party further centrist, and then eventually even pushing it right in some regards. And I could no longer stand by a party that didn't support the same values as me.
Right. And this was actually something I was going to ask you about as well. Like, in terms of when you joined the Communist Party in the first place. Well, first of all, did socialism really drive you to join the NDP originally?
Yeah, no, it did. Like, as a teenager growing up with Jack Layton, that was definitely my first drive towards politics.
Right. And, of course, so them taking socialism out of the platform, removing it entirely from their entire mode of operation, stuff like
and
that.
And not only that, but
yeah.
The entire history section of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, they completely tried to remove any legacy of progressive change that they brought to the country.
Mm-hmm. So what inspired you to get involved with the CPC in particular after you left the NDP? You know, like joining the Communist Party, that's still a major step.
After the election of Donald Trump when I got involved.
Right. So that was 20...
When the Charlottesville riots happened and people were marching, holding torches, yelling, "Jews will not replace us," I felt like the current political options are not going to keep people safe.
Right. So it was basically the rise of the far right played a major role in you deciding to become a communist.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so, and seeing that kind of threat emerge, right? And
especially London, which historically has been the heart of the fascist movement in Canada. The Canadian Nazi Party was founded here.
Right.
The Ku Klux Klan would burn crosses on the property of the person who founded that party, Martin Weiss.
Yeah. So this is like a very, you know, you see this threat going on in London right now, like around
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Around the city, you can even identify neo-Nazis. They openly wear swastika necklaces.
Wow. Yeah, that is pretty scary.
That, people outside the city don't talk about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no kidding. I mean, you definitely don't see that in the media, you know, getting covered, getting talked about, that sort of thing. But obviously, like, if it's going on around you, I mean, you're seeing this. So, but like focusing on the election, like I said, the article I was reading in the London Fuse was talking about how it was a really tight race in the riding you were in between the Greens, the Liberals, the NDP, and the PC. And it was really quite intense, like, kind of campaign. And it talked about how you kind of were stuck in the other category, so to speak. And that getting noticed was a tough one for you because you were up against kind of almost a, I guess not entirely a media blackout, but something approximate to that to some degree, seeing if you're in another candidate. So what was it really like to fight such an uphill battle, and what tactics did you find effective in order to, well, you know, get noticed, like, in the campaign?
Definitely. I agree with you. I do think that there was a deliberate effort to censor me. Rogers TV, for instance, invited our party leader, Dave McKee, to debate in the last election. They had our contact information. So did all the other stations. It's all publicly listed.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was because something was going on. It was very obvious when, through social media, I was able to get so much coverage. But locally, there was nothing. Besides the London Fuse article you mentioned, no one else reached out.
Wow. So you found like social media to be the real, the really useful tool for getting past that, or like were there
Absolutely.
Other tools? Yeah. Like, so how did you really make use of that?
Through it. I mean, there's in every city, there are, for instance, Facebook groups for everything. It's very easy to get the word out if you need to the community without using corporate media.
Yeah. So it was mainly like Facebook was the most useful like platform, like to really reach people.
Like London, Ontario buy and sell groups about culture, groups for music. There are all sorts of ways to get in contact with people locally in the community.
Mm.
Besides that, I literally just went door to door. I went business to business. I even found businesses that became supporters of the Communist Party.
Wow. So how did that work? Like, that's not something I've seen before.
Pharma shop. And I just went in there to canvas. I was like, hello, my name's Clara. I'm the London North Center candidate for the Communist Party. And it turns out that it was a family that was from the Soviet Union.
Wow.
He said he's even going to join the party in September. I'm really excited to see like all of this progress that's going on. People who would otherwise be afraid to call themselves a communist are now stepping out.
Right. Which of course that's quite a phenomenon, seeing the kind of society that we live in, which kind of marginalizes people who express these kind of views. Like say the radical revolutionary views.
Mm. I definitely think it's just the result that the Soviet Union collapsed, and they keep trying to use anti-communist propaganda, but they keep going in the past. They can't point to anything wrong about Cuba now. They can't point to anything wrong about China that isn't dispensationalized. They have to go back into black and white archives, and they have to try and attach us to things that have nothing to do with the Communist Party of Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I remember that definitely was the case when I was running in the federal election back in 2015. I remember that, actually. I mean, I got there was definitely some red baiting, which I faced, like one time, you know, I'm just at like a debate which happened in a senior center, actually, in Guelph. And it was like basically this old Polish guy came up to me and basically talked about how, you know, in 1945, you know, supposedly the communists did something to his family. You know, and they're just like, you know, like someone in this family got sent to Siberia or something like that. And this is the kind of thing which, well, yeah, like like I say, like that's about the only thing you really can get.
What I try and do is make people understand that just because it has the same name, it is not the same party. A Hungarian man, he approached me when I was going door to door, and what I told him that I think made sense to him was I asked him, is there a liberal party in Hungary? And he said, yes. And I said, are they the same party as the Liberal Party of Canada?
Right.
And he said, no.
Well, no.
Two different parties, two different histories.
Yeah, like, exactly. I mean, you're dealing with completely different histories, different historical time periods, different conflicts going on, all this sort of stuff. And, of course, we know what that's like, you know, facing like red baiting. I mean, there was that incident, and then there was the incident which happened when I was in a. They didn't even allow me to speak at this one, and that's something I'm going to ask you about, like with some of the debates you dealt with. But I mean, in this particular case, this was actually a Fair Vote Guelph event. You know, like Fair Vote Canada. Like this was a local chapter, and they didn't allow me on the panel because I didn't meet their criteria. You know, I mean, apparently our party was too small to fit in with the, you know, with their, no, I guess it, they, it I guess they were going on the New Zealand model. They were going on the New Zealand model of like of proportional representation. Wouldn't have made the cut, I guess, if we were using the New Zealand model in terms of the proportion of the vote we got. But anyway, I actually did get red baited there by like a member of the audience when I actually stood up and demanded to be on the panel. And this guy basically stood up and said, "Oh yeah, if the communists ever won, there would be no more elections," and just spouting at this vitriol, like an older man here. I don't know what his background was. He seemed like a white Anglo guy, though. So
I mean, my family is from Italy. I can tell you that the Italian communists won many elections without ending elections.
Right. Because anybody who really knows that kind of history, right, can see how what nonsense that is.
They're not looking to learn. They're looking to heckle you.
Of course. So anyway, so I'm going to ask you about like what your experience was in getting shut out of debates, because I mean, I hear you did have to fight hard sometimes to get a place. And so what was that like? Like what was the situation with the debating and getting on debates in London?
Well, I only was able to get on to one debate in London. There were several debates. And only two of them I was actually invited to. I could have applied to a third at the school, but as a small party, we don't have our own campaigning headquarters or armies of volunteers. We're mostly doing it on our own.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was shut out of many debates, I will concede that there was the high school debate, which I was too overworked to attend.
Right.
And the CIBC debate, not CIBC, CBC.
CBC debate.
Yeah. I don't think I'd be invited to the CIBC debate.
Like, if they had one.
Yeah.
Right.
The CBC debate, I had to turn that one down because that was the day that Dave McKee and Adrian Welsh, leader of the Young Communist League, came down to London. That was also the day the London Fuse article was published.
Right. So on the 4th.
Right. I found one tactic very useful, just calling out their pages, make sure the call out is public so everyone can see it, and every response that they give you is also made public.
Right. So this is on social media doing this.
Oh, yeah. And I did get some responses from Rogers through that. I did get the London Youth Advisory Council reached out and apologized to me for not inviting me to an event where they invited other candidates.
Mm-hmm. So you actually did get an apology one time.
One time.
Right.
But it's still more than in previous years, I guess.
Right.
Actually, no, that's not true. As I said, Rogers made the decision not to invite us this year, even though they did in the previous year, previous election.
And there was no explanation for that?
No explanation. They tried to say it was because it was a community-organized event, but I don't buy when they say things like that to me. Anyone there could have said anything.
Right.
Any of the other candidates, Terence Kernahan, who was elected, he could have made the decision at every single debate to say, I would only participate if all the candidates are represented.
Right.
But he doesn't make.
But he doesn't do that.
No. He likes that I got shut out of the debate.
Right. It's like that is his stance, like his reactionary stance, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I approached him at the only debate I managed to make it to, the London Health Coalition debate. And, you know, he tried to shake my hand. I told him no. I was really mad.
Well, yeah, no kidding.
And when I said, why don't you speak up about it, he said, am I supposed to?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? If he's trying to represent the people in the community and he's not trying to make it so all the people are informed about all their political choices.
Right. I mean, come on. Right. I mean, and he tries to shake your hand, act all friendly, act all nice.
The politician act. I can see that from a mile away.
Yeah. It is not hard to, you know, pick out that kind of thing. So in that one debate, you did get. You said that was the Health Coalition debate. Like, how did that? How did that pan out? How did that go?
That went great, I think. Like, we had a whole row of supporters, and it's because we already work closely with the London Health Coalition. Some of our members, who also are in medical school, work with the London Health Coalition because we are trying to fight the fact that London has the worst hospitals in the entire province.
Mm-hmm. Like, facing austerity in, like, really, really hard.
Yeah, well, they instituted May 1st, or June 1st, the hallway transfer protocol at Victoria Hospital. So what that What that means is that they can see patients in hallways. And they went further, and I haven't seen any of the other politicians bring this up, even at the debate, that in it, they define hallway as any unconventional space that can accommodate a bed or a stretcher.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Room, bathroom, if it's a crisis, they will see patients out of them, apparently. That's where healthcare is amended.
Oh, my God. Because that was my next question, actually, is like, what are the material conditions in London right now? And how do you think the Communist Party platform, how do you think that they would improve them? Like, really? I know the platform that we're running on this really anti-austerity platform, right? And like, obviously, it sounds, based on that picture you're giving me,
austerity is
hitting hard.
About the policies, and I found the ones that people really liked are childcare policies.
Mm-hmm.
Like single parents who have to somehow juggle raising a kid and holding a job to support their kid. It's just not a feasible situation. And people wonder why the birth rate is declining.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, I found that convenience store clerks and owners were very supportive of the Communist Party and our plan to cut the harmonized sales tax.
Right. Which, of course, is a regressive tax, mm-hmm. right? Like flat tax, basically affecting like the ones who are least able to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you found that they were really responding to the... that's interesting. Like you said, like convenience store owners. We're responding favorably to that.
Well, I mean, a lot of people who run convenience stores, they're running it by themselves or they're running it with their family, and it's not always a very profitable venture.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe the reason it resonated so well is because of the problem with cigarettes and how they've raised taxes so high on it that it drives away business, and cigarette business was one of their main sources of business. They also have to compete with on reserve cigarettes, which do not have the taxes applied.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to get into whether or not that is something that should be an issue. That's not the point.
Yeah. So, because like this kind of goes into just generally condition. I mean, there's quite high levels of employment, unemployment, I should say, in London right now, right? And just like, what is the, like London's a former like industrial city. So what is the situation with industry in London right now?
The situation with industry, we had the Caterpillar Corporation. I think it was in 2011 or 2012 when they decided to shut down. They moved all the way to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Where people were paid half the wages they were paid to work in the London factory. So, and that was all thanks to NATO.
Right.
I mean, NAFTA.
NAFTA. So once again, you have like the free trade kind of like agreements that result in the city basically becoming a Rust Belt city.
Yeah, and London is definitely a Rust Belt city. We lost... in recent years, the Kellogg factory, in former years, the McCormick's factory. There's more business coming up, but unfortunately, that business is related to defense.
Mm-hmm. This is like the armaments industry
called,
moving in.
It's Civil Logistics, I believe.
Right. So, because this is, I was hearing about this. This was like the... and this was defended by Unifor, if I recall, like earlier this year. Like the arms industry really expanding its role. I believe it was armored combat vehicles, and this was like the armored combat vehicles that were going to get sold to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
and which have since been used in Yemen, and we actually do know that because Yemeni resistance fighters have actually knocked out some of them and actually have posed for pictures with these, you know, combat vehicles, which were sold to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia used them in aggressive war in Yemen, and then they were knocked out, and here they are for all to see,
mm-hmm.
right?
And
manufactured
it's
in London.
It's a bad situation because employment is so scarce in London that a lot of people are willing to take it, even though they have a moral conflict with what they're doing.
Right. Because I was going to ask you, like, what role... So the arms industry is effectively the only real big manufacturing industry left. Is that right?
I know that there's also a vibrant tech industry blooming in London. There's StarTech. There's a few gaming studios that have been opening up.
Right.
Besides that, no new industry is really popping up in the city.
Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty bleak kind of picture. Like especially if you're talking.
I don't know if you've heard, but they're just implementing bus rapid transit now.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that they came up with in the 1970s. They never implemented in our city. We're larger than many of the surrounding cities, but we don't even have 24-hour buses here. So if you work a night shift job, you need to have a car or you need to live close.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because obviously you can't get anywhere with public transit at that time. So yeah, but about the arms industry, just to talk a little more about that, has it been like an obstacle for you at all? Like, I mean, have you talked to people who, you tell them about all the progressive policies that the Communist Party has that we're talking about, like, you know, jobs, reinvigorating the economy, this sort of thing, and putting power in the hands of working people. But then mm-hmm. they're relying on these arms manufacturers. So when we talk about, like, say, having like a peaceful, like, policy abroad, not like manufacturing like arms, like, are they resistant on the basis of that?
Or an issue because the people who work there make enough money that they're usually in suburbs.
Right.
And other neighborhoods that I completely avoided during my campaign. Because the policies that the Communist Party wants to put through are the policies that the people living in geared to rent housing or living on the streets,
mm-hmm.
going to the methadone clinics. London actually has the second highest rate of syringe use under Vancouver.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty serious.
Yeah, no, It definitely is a problem. Combined with the healthcare crisis in London, I don't see any way out of it that doesn't involve breaking out of the political mold here.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, the need for systemic change, if you're actually going to face these problems, mm-hmm. right? So I actually want to read a quote from Communist Party of Ontario leader Dave McKee. And I'm assuming he said this at the same time he was there and was visiting you with Adrian and helping out with the campaign. And he said, you know, about you, she's been extremely energetic in her campaign. As a young person, she has a lot of ideas on outreach. She helps us make sure that we're speaking to that particular section of the working class as well as to an older demographic. So I really wanted to ask you what... has the response to the campaign been from young people in particular? Like, because that seems to be really a group that you're really trying to energize in this.
It's definitely positive among young people. I find it's more positive among the people who grew up in London than the students that come here from out of the city.
Mm.
London is definitely known as a big student town. We have Western University. It's also known as one of the most conservative campuses in the country.
Yeah, Western.
Yeah. So it has been an uphill battle with the youth. So I find the people in London feel very disenfranchised because, as I said, with job perspectives, if you don't have a car, you can't work a night shift. Most of the jobs here are minimum wage jobs, which aren't providing a living wage. You can't expect to raise a family on one of those.
Yeah. So, like, the prospects of especially... So, youth unemployment, I'm assuming, is probably higher than general unemployment.
Oh, absolutely.
By a pretty major, like, factor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in London. So,
Yeah, and I...